John Lehman. I live at 2111 Jefferson Davis Highway, Arlington, Virginia, 22202. I attended the University of Wisconsin during the school year 1927-1928 and from 1929 to 1932. I graduated from Sparta High School. I think it was probably just assumed that I would attend college. My father had taught in the engineering college at the University of Wisconsin. My mother was a graduate of Valparaiso University, and I guess the question didn't really ever come up whether or not I would attend college. I don't think I had a specific career goal in mind, as someone might have had they already selected their profession. I do know that I wanted to graduate from college and have a worthwhile job. There wasn't really very much to the orientation program, as I recall, or perhaps I didn't participate that much. I knew the campus well. I had lived in Madison, so what I needed mostly was help from my advisor, who reviewed my program to see that I had all the electives in the proper order. The registration process was really pretty horrendous. I recall going from table to table, probably from instructor to instructor at those tables, and then finally, having all that in order, having to go to the bursar line, which seems to me now to have stretched for blocks and blocks. It was so bad that I recall one time later in my college career that as I faced the whole registration process and stood outside of Langdon Hall, I almost said, "The heck with it, I think I'll go home." I transferred to the University of Illinois in order to enter the School of Architecture. I had become disenchanted with the engineering courses that I was taking, and I had done very, very well in English. I had a romantic notion that the imagination I was using in my English classes could be combined with my engineering skill in the form of an architectural career. I didn't know one thing, and that was that in order to be a good architect, I also had to do very good freehand drawing. I could do the formal engineering drawing all right, but I was not very good at the freehand drawing. So I decided to come back to Wisconsin after the end of 1 year at Illinois. I turn now to the section in your outline noted as my major. I start with a puzzle. Among the names of the faculty members, I do not find W. Baird Taylor, who taught me corporation finance, investments, and was my major professor for my graduate year. It occurs to me that there may have been a separate school of accounting, and that for some reason finance may have been in the school of accounting, and perhaps that's why Baird Taylor's name is not listed in the economics faculty. If there was such a school, I do recall that there was an exchange going back and forth, so you could really take courses in either one. And my major as a graduate student was corporation finance. My major as an undergraduate student was public utilities. So I'd like to start by talking about W. Baird Taylor. He was a natural teacher. He was very interested in his subject, and he came to us about the time that Burley and Means had written a very interesting and definitive book called Corporation and Private Property. It was, in effect, an examination of the relationship of the corporation to modern society. Professor Taylor, as a young, vigorous, interested person, made much of that kind of analysis very real for us. And he made you feel just how the corporation really worked in the society we live in. He later had a long career at the University of Redlands in California. I've already talked about Professor Commons, about his great teaching at his Friday nights. Now, actually, he probably used the Socratic method there about as well as anyone could. But there were really almost two Professor Commons. There was the Friday night Professor Commons and the very earthy discussions that were held at his house. And then there was the Professor Commons, the theoretician who taught institutional economics. For many of us, that was a little heavy, particularly when he opened for a group of undergraduates with a long discussion of the philosophy of the Scottish philosopher Hume. That was his introduction, our introduction really, to institutional economics. And it was a little too theoretical and didn't really seem to come together very well for us. It was when he was talking about labor economics and what could happen on the picket line and how labor and industry must get together that he was really very, very good and very understandable. In any event, he was a delightful person and a wonderful human being. I also have talked about Professor Kiekover, and he was indeed the kind of person I mentioned. He was slightly pompous, a little stuffy, and almost over-organized. Each year he put out a new volume of the outlines which accompanied his textbook. Those outlines became, of course, the basis for all his lectures. And if you could remember what was in the outline, you could almost always do well in the course. He really was a lecturer. He didn't do much classroom teaching, and he kind of mass-produced economics for undergraduates, which was not a bad thing. Let me say he was not a Keynesian by any means. He started with Adam Smith and didn't get too far beyond him. Professor Scott was already quite elderly when I took his course in economic thought. Actually, I think it was called The History of Economic Thought. At that time, he worked on a rather unique schedule. He was at the campus for the first half of the first semester, and on the campus for the second half of the second semester. The rest of the time he spent in Florida. So if you took a 2-credit course, you took it actually as a 4-credit course for half of a semester. He was, I think, the only professor I really was ever scared of. His practice was to start down the rows and ask each person in the class a question. Then he would comment on the answer that you gave to that question. I was an undergraduate in a graduate course, and I remember him saying to one graduate student, "Mr. Brown, do you think that answer is worthy of a graduate student in economics?" Now, Professor Scott had some right to claim fame in the field of money and banking. He had written a very good money and banking textbook. He had lectured widely in the college, in other colleges, in money and banking, and he was a recognized authority in that field. Even though by the time I had him, he was getting a little old and a little crotchety. Professor Glaser was a truly gentle person. He was an excellent scholar and a good teacher in what was a very, very important field, particularly at that time when we were seeing the development of what came to be known as utility economics. I enjoyed his classes and I enjoyed him as an individual. I also respected him highly because he was widely used by state and national commissions as a consultant. He embodied, again, the whole principle of the Wisconsin idea, where the faculty of the university was made itself available to the state legislature or to the state government to bring to that government the expertise that it would have in a particular field. Harry Jerome was my statistics professor and was an excellent lecturer. However, at that time he was chairman of the department and he did nothing but give the lectures. He did not participate with the classes in any other way. Fortunately, there was an excellent instructor by the name of Phil Fox, whose name I find missing in the list. Fox later went on to become a distinguished statistician and statistical statistics professor at the University of Iowa. The great thing about Professor Jerome's lectures was that he was able to really bring out the beauty of a good mathematical solution. Margaret Pryor was a pioneer in consumer economics when that was hardly recognized as a course. She made us instantly interested in her course because everything she taught was from real life. It was about how your clothes would wear, what kind of automobile tires you should buy, and the sort of thing you might find today in consumer research. Of course, she did relate it to general principles of economics, but it was really, I think, probably the first course in consumer economics in the land. And when you think now of all that we have by way of consumer representatives in the national and state governments, and even in the city governments, I think much of that sort of development can go right back to the kind of courses that Margaret Pryor taught. Harold Groves, who taught taxation, truly epitomized the Wisconsin idea. He was a fine scholar teacher who served the legislature and the state well as a frequent consultant on tax design and impact. Anyone who took his course was a better citizen for it because he understood how government must be financed, how it must spend its money, and how to make sure that both of those things were done in the best fashion possible. One of my great privileges in latter years was to, as a staff member of the Joint Economic Committee of the Congress, invite Harold Groves to come as a member of a distinguished panel to discuss with the committee the future of taxes in the United States. I also enjoyed Harold Groves as an athlete. He was a fine tennis player, an excellent skater, and could be found anywhere on the lower campus where the softball action was the hottest. I have mentioned in my earlier notes how Professor Trumbauer plodded through the rather unexciting material in transportation economics. He was known for his stack of blue examination notebooks, which contained his lecture notes. One stack, one course, one book, one day's lecture, a very neat system. He was a good, worthwhile journeyman professor operating in a field that wasn't very glamorous. He did do some research with the State Highway Commission. Also, he was always available for the departmental administrative chores that nobody else wanted to do. The department was strong at that time in public utilities, public finance, corporation finance, history of economic thought, and consumer economics. They were probably weak in theory, and that might go back to when Richard Ely left the faculty. My favorite courses were probably public utilities, public finance, and consumer economics. I suppose they were my favorite because of the way these people were able to apply economic theory to the problems of the day. As you might have guessed from my previous notes, my favorite class outside of economics was probably Harry Hayden Clark's American Literature class. It was my favorite because it covered material that I loved. It was my favorite because The material was presented in a most attractive fashion by a man who understood the undergraduate mind and who had a lively sense of humor that wasn't used carelessly, but was used often to make the point much more clear. In any of my favorite courses, I think there was probably the underlying feeling that the person teaching the course was highly qualified and really knew the material he was talking about. I think the undergraduate senses pretty early when a teacher is uncomfortable with the particular course that he's giving on that day. Also, all the great professors, it seemed to me, were skilled in the use of the language. Harry Hayden, now we turn to housing. I decided to live in a residence hall, I believe, because I think that freshmen, if they came from out of Madison, were required to live in a residence hall. I did spend one other semester in the residence hall, and I did that because it was a great bargain. I bought someone's unexpired contract for the second semester at a tremendous saving. So altogether, I lived a year and a half in the residence halls. I don't remember the resident house fellow in my second residence hall stay, but the fellow in my first residence hall was Charles First, F-U-R-S-T. As far as his job, I think that in some sense he felt he was acting in loco parentis, but most of the time he was just a good source of information, and he had an excellent set of classical records. I was not on any student resident hall committees. Now, as to a typical evening meal, I don't believe there were any real rules about dress. The tables were arranged pretty much in ordinary dormitory style, or refectory style, I guess you would say. The food was served in the evening by waiters, as I recall, but was served family style, and we passed the dishes around the table. Desserts often were put on the table before we sat down to the meal. Cafeteria style was prevailed in the morning. I do not recall a prayer being offered. Yes, the food was good, in spite of all the folklore about college food. I am sure our dorm had some kind of house rules, but I don't remember very much about them, or who made them, or what the punishment was for breaking them. Somehow or other, we just seemed to get along without too much reference to rules. I left the dorm for off-campus housing for a little more flexibility, and also, as you recall, I had gone to the University of Illinois, and then when I came back, I had to make a somewhat temporary arrangement, and I just never got back into the dormitories. At Illinois, I had belonged to an architectural fraternity, and since there wasn't such a fraternity on the campus at Wisconsin, I was not particularly interested in belonging to another fraternity, and that left me quite free to select any kind of housing I wanted. I lived in two different rooming houses, one of which was next to Ann Emery Hall, I remember, and another one of which had, in conjunction with the rooming house, a boarding house. Even when I lived at the house next to Ann Emery, I boarded at the other rooming house. In addition to the rooming houses, I also lived at the bachelor apartments and for a while in a private home. Almost all the other people in the two rooming houses were students, and I suppose there were perhaps 12 to 15 or perhaps as many as 20 students living in each of those houses. The houses, of course, were those big old four-story houses that were so prevalent on Langdon Street and just off Langdon Street. I suppose most of them were built sometime in the early 1900s. And the two I lived in were in quite good condition. In neither house did I have a roommate. My rooms were quite large, and in one case had a nice view across the lake. We usually shared a bath on each floor, which would mean perhaps as many as 6 or 8 sharing a bath. I don't recall any formal house rules for the rooming houses. The policies were set pretty much by the owner of the house, and he let you know if you were doing something that he disagreed with. The bachelor apartments, which were located on a short street paralleling Langdon, perhaps halfway up the hill, were occupied by students and graduate students for the most part, although there were a few people from downtown Madison, perhaps from state government, who lived there. To call them apartments was a little much. Actually, they were nice large rooms with private baths. They were more like hotel rooms than apartment rooms. There were no cooking facilities, as I recall. That was the only place where, to my knowledge, you could bring home members of the opposite sex. Even there, it was done a little surreptitiously. I don't think I will try to add very much to my earlier remarks about leisure time. As far as the role of religion in my campus experience, it came about in about 2 or 3 different forms. My freshman year, I sang in the choir of the Methodist Church downtown on West Washington Street. I had friends in Madison who belonged to that church. They took me to church, and when it was known that I was singing in the glee club, the choir director asked if I would come and sing in their choir on Sunday mornings. Later on, I sang in the choir of the Congregational Church up on Breeze Terrace. I did that because I'd grown up in a Congregational Church, also because they had a splendid choir, and the third and perhaps most important reason was that the minister there was Alfred Swan, who later became the National Secretary for the Congregational Church. He was a splendid man and a very, very fine preacher. I had had good ministers in my little town of Sparta, Wisconsin, but he was just a cut above everybody as far as his pulpit presence and his messages were concerned. So I pretty much carried on my religious activities in the way I would at home. I went to church and sang in the choir and listened to the sermons. I remember going to some of the meetings of campus religious houses, I think largely because they were having some speaker that I wanted to hear. I even remember going to the Newman House, which I believe is a Catholic house. The major spectator sports on campus when I was there were football, basketball, track, crew, and baseball. I became involved in freshman hockey largely because I read someplace that you could take freshman hockey instead of some intramural sport. And I had played a little very crude hockey and felt it would be fun to try something at a little higher level. Fortunately, they didn't cut anybody from the freshman teams. They needed all the bodies they could have for the varsity to practice against. And that's about as far as I got in hockey. The coach was Art Thompson. Art also coached a swimming team and had come to Wisconsin from the Milwaukee Athletic Club. In those days, the athletic clubs had very, very fine teams, almost on a professional level. He was a swimmer and had played hockey for the Milwaukee Athletic Club, and when he played hockey, he was a teammate of Ching Johnson and Taffy Abel, who were later to go on and become legendary figures with the New York Rangers. Thompson was an easygoing fellow who knew the mechanics of his sports well, but who did not go overboard in trying to inspire or who was not that competitive. He liked to win, but he also was a good teacher, and he was very patient with beginning hockey players. In those days, there was no inter-school competition for the freshmen, and freshmen did not play on any of the school varsities. The varsity played in a six-team league, I believe, that included Michigan School of Mines and another School of Mines from Hibbing, Minnesota, perhaps North Dakota and Minnesota. I don't remember exactly, but it was a small league. The team as a whole, the varsity that is, performed very well and did have an unbeaten season that year before the thaws came in January, melted the ice, and they couldn't practice, and then they lost all the rest of the games. They had two outstanding players in the Mickeljohn brothers, one of whom was so good that in years later, when I was talking to one of the Patricks, who was at that time the coach of the Kansas City Blues, he said that Gordy Mickeljohn, who went on to play at McGill University, imagine an American playing at a Canadian university, he said that Gordy Mickeljohn shouldn't ever have become a doctor. He should have gone on and become a professional hockey player. He was that good. Yes, their father was the Mickeljohn of the Experimental College. My involvement in the mixed doubles tournament came about because Tony Kernjack, who was at that time the captain of the Wisconsin varsity, had played with me several summers before, and he was looking for someone to partner with a girl who was quite a good player and who had no partner that she had been playing with regularly. That was my graduate year, but I was eligible because anyone on the campus could play in that mixed doubles tournament. I suppose the greatest thrill of that tournament, and really one of the greatest thrills of my tennis career, which incidentally is still going on, was in the semifinals of the tournament. We beat a member of the varsity and his partner in three sets, and that was the highlight of the tournament for me. We lost in the finals to Frank Parker and his partner. Parker was also playing on the Wisconsin varsity, and he is not the Frank Parker of Davis Cup fame, but he is the Frank Parker who went on from there and various other tournaments to win the National Public Parks Tournament in Minneapolis. I think Frank came from St. Louis. There is even a picture of the two teams in the finals in the Daily Cardinal. I think I have my medal still, but I believe the picture is gone. My education was financed by my family and by my summer earnings, although I also worked as a draftsman and drew all the soil maps of Bayfield County for the agricultural department. I think I got the job through the college placement office. I don't know how long I had it, although I do know that I had it for at least one semester and part of another one, and I can't possibly remember how much it paid. Clubs and organizations. I suppose I became involved in men's glee club the way an athlete becomes involved in a sport. I had been very, very active in the glee clubs and mixed choruses, state competitions, and so forth when I was in high school. So the natural thing to do when I came to university was to see if I could become a member of the men's glee club. The glee club was directed by E. Earl Swinney, a large, white-haired, very formal, but nonetheless very friendly man, a good musician, and a very, very hard worker. We rehearsed in music hall, and I believe we rehearsed at least weekly. If we were doing concerts, we rehearsed oftener than that. Our major concert was also in music hall, but we performed some concerts in other cities and some concerts in other halls around Madison. Don't recall exactly where those were. I do know that we had an unusual arrangement with a radio station in Janesville, where for a whole semester, or at least over the winter, we went down one night a week and did a half-hour concert on that radio station. That meant leaving Madison about perhaps 5:30 in a bus, riding down, doing the concert, coming back at night. It was a very much of a fun thing. We got a lot of enjoyment out of it, but it took a lot of doing because we had, I think, by the end of the season, we had done over 100 different numbers. We had about 20 of those committed to memory for our formal concerts. Glee Club concerts in those days were highly popular as a form of entertainment, and ours were very, very well attended, both by town and gown. The latter, of course, including a lot of our fellow students. I don't remember too much about the other singing groups on the campus. There was a fine women's glee club. We combined with them for several concerts, and I believe that I one year sang in a mixed chorus, which probably had membership from both the women's and the men's glee club. I became involved in Arden House because several of us were taking a freshman English class from Charlotte Wood. We apparently did quite well. As a matter of fact, I think all of us had all A's. And we did particularly well in some of our original writing. Charlotte Wood, sensing that we had an interest in things literary, invited us to go to a meeting, or I believe it was actually a tea at Arden House, to hear some distinguished literary scholar speak and answer questions. And that Arden House was located between State Street and University Avenue in a kind of court which was about opposite the back of Music Hall. As I understand it now, it was a rooming house for students who were interested in literature or who were probably English majors, much as the Spanish House was a rooming house where you had Spanish majors. In addition, the house held functions where they invited visiting authors. As I said in my earlier piece, Vachel Lindsay came one time. They also were responsible for promoting the appearance of literary giants before larger audiences on the campus, sometimes I think in Music Hall, actually. The house was also a social club and had Saturday night social activities, including dances, as I recall. I don't think I went to any other places or exactly like Arden House. I don't really remember how I came to have my own show on WHA. I can only surmise. I do recall that I had taken lessons from Earl Swinney, the director of the Glee Club, and I had done some solo work with the club. He frequently got inquiries about available singers, and it might be that somebody had asked him, someone from WHA, where they had a blank spot to fill in their program. I think I sang from 12 to 12:30. The reason I remember that so well is because the lady who will have been Mrs. Lehman for 50 years in September used to go down into the furnace room at the school in Fond du Lac where she was teaching, where she could listen to that music on the janitor's radio. The format of the show was a very simple one. I had an accompanist, and I just sang a series of songs to fill up a half an hour. After the first appearance, I did invite people to call in and ask for favorite songs, and that worked pretty well. It meant, of course, that I also had to broaden my repertoire quite a bit. Shows using student talent were quite common. I'm not sure there were too many that involved just a single soloist. And of course, mine only lasted about a semester. After that, I don't know really what happened to it. As you may or may not know, WHA is the second oldest radio station in the United States. I think only KDKA in Pittsburgh is older. I remember as a small boy in Madison that we used to marvel at this wonderful thing, this radio station that could be heard all the way over to Wingra Park. The facilities were, I think, quite good for the times. They looked like almost any picture you would see of a crooner or ballad singer before one of those big bulbous mics in the 1920s or early 30s. I don't recall that the Men's Glee Club Pin and Key was anything very much more than just a series of awards, much as you would award numerals or varsity letters. It may have been that the officers of the Glee Club could only be from among those persons who held the Glee Club pin or the Glee Club key. They were more awards for a year's service or for several years' service or for distinguished service of some kind. I think most everybody, before they were through, probably got a pin. The keys were reserved for persons who had done something special with the club. As to publications, yes, I did read the Daily Cardinal. I found it excellent. It was a professional quality, and it gave remarkable coverage as a real daily paper. I don't really know how they did it. A number of the staff members were friends of mine. I had high regard for their writing ability, and of course that high regard has been justified many times since then by the fine work that they have done since they left the campus. The Octopus was a funny humor magazine, as good as they come, and I found the Cardinal point of view to reflect quite accurately the attitudes of most of the campus. It was an independent paper and should be so as a campus newspaper. As far as students' attitudes are concerned, wrongly or rightly, it seemed that most students didn't have time to have an attitude. It was not that they were not concerned with national affairs. They were, and often there were national speakers who came to the campus. But the problems of the day were the problems of unemployment and how to get the economy going and what you could do for or with the unemployed. As for actual discrimination, I can recall only discussion about possible discrimination by some of the fraternities in regard to Jewish members. Some members of the Wisconsin legislature would have you believe that there were radical or communist groups on campus. But radicalism in those days simply meant voting for Norman Thomas and for what we would think of as a socialist state. I don't recall any real Communist Party activity, although there possibly could have been some. I think the general student attitude toward these groups, if they existed, was one of curiosity rather than concern. As to some of the personalities of the day, I do not have a real clear picture of Scott Goodnight. I met with him twice. Once when I came back from the University of Illinois and needed to discuss a problem of transferring credits. At that time, he was quite approachable and seemed to me came up with a very fair answer. My other association with him was as chairman of the Student Elections Committee. He had oversight of that committee, and I reported to him the kinds of activities we were planning and the kinds of results that we got from those activities. He again seemed to be quite understanding. I'm not sure that he commented particularly one way or the other, as long as the job was being well done. Nothing seems to stand at all about George Sellery. I do remember that he was a scholarly gentleman, but beyond that, nothing comes clear at this time. On the other hand, Glenn Frank was a most attractive person and personality. He had great style. He was fearless in defense of the university and very good at it. And he was just a good man trying to do something to improve the world. As a speaker, he was a real spellbinder, and his ability to turn a literary phrase was marvelous. I remember him referring to one of his opponents as a person who was a Pollyanna piping in a daisy patch. He thought, spoke, and acted like my idea of a college president. Under item 11, the lower end of State Street was Madison for most students. Some of us did spend time watching the legislature in action, and there were a few who may have shopped at stores around the square. But for the most part, we stayed pretty close to the lower end of State Street. We bought our books and supplies at the co-op. We bought our clothes from Pete Burns and Cog McNeil. And we thought it was pretty neat when Pete Burns went out to San Francisco and opened a shop on the top of a hotel, which he called Pete Burns Coat and Penthouse. Serious drug supplies came from Rennebaum's drugstore. Across from Rennebaum's about, there was a chocolate shop that had the best sundaes and the best malted milks I think I have ever eaten. At one time, the chocolate shop was called Keeley's Palace of Sweets and was the home of Keeley's old-fashioned chocolates. I believe you can still get Keeley's old-fashioned chocolates in Madison. My recollection of them is that they were better than Godiva's. I don't recall any problems existing between the students and the State Street merchants, nor do I know of any merchants that were regularly accused of ripping off the students. The biggest problem between students and the police involved racing cars up and down Langdon Street. We did sometimes get beyond State Street when we wanted a special dinner or a special steak. If it was the steak, we went to Chili Al's, a steakhouse roughly behind the Park Hotel, and a place where you saw not only students, but a great many of the Wisconsin state legislators. If it was a fancy meal, we would go to the Lorraine Hotel. For swimming and outdoor recreation, of course, we went to the Willows or to Picnic Point. If it was a nightclub, it was apt to be the Chanticleer, which was out at Middleton. As to the effects of the Depression, I was fortunate in that my father had a very good, stable job with the state government. He even had access to ready cash during the bank holiday, and for several weeks, I sustained four or five of my friends out of my own pocket. My concern was largely what was happening to others and what was happening to the national economy and what was happening to the nation. I also was fortunate in having a source of summer jobs. But after I graduated with my BA, then it became tougher. Then I could not find a job I went to several places in Madison. I went to Chicago. I did not find work. So back to school, which seemed to be the wisest thing to do. Some of my classmates did find jobs, but few in their chosen careers. One of my friends had just finished engineering school, and to this day, he never used anything of his engineering training, at least as far as his profession and work was concerned. He became an insurance salesman. Others of my friends had to drop out of school when their families lost large sums of money in banks that failed, or were in business. The university fought hard to hold its budget, and a number of the state offices were closed or curtailed in some way or another. The advent of the New Deal brought some relief in the form of special work projects. For example, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration provided funds for an extension division project that involved the hiring of 20 economic lecturers to go up. We divided up the state, and four or five of us would cover a particular area. I remember lecturing to students in the seventh grade and also to the Rotary Club at La Crosse, Wisconsin. And there was no subject too large or too small for us to tackle as long as it had something to do with economics. By 1934, it was apparent that the great job market was in Washington, D.C., and particularly the job market for economists. Not that I became an economist when I went to seek my fortune in Washington. I actually became a file clerk on the midnight shift of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, and it was not until the next year that I went to the Tennessee Valley Authority as an economist in their Social and Economic Research Division. But being from Wisconsin was a great asset in those days. Much of Altmaier were writing the Social Security Act with the help of my friend Wilbur Cohen, who in the Johnson cabinet became Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. When I went to TVA for my first professional job, I was surrounded by people from Wisconsin. David Lilienthal, of course, came from the Wisconsin Public Service Commission to be a member of the board of the Tennessee Valley Authority. Reflecting on my career goals at graduation and later upon receiving my master's, I suppose that I was mostly concerned with earning a living, probably with being a useful citizen, and trying to do something about society's ills. While your career goals never end, I think along the way I probably have accomplished much of what I set out to do. I did not set out to be in Who's Who, to be an American Men of Science, to become a fellow of two learned societies, to work closely with and travel with over 50 members of the United States Congress, to work closely with several members of the President's Cabinet. None of these things did I plan as part of my career, but they all happened. And I think one reason that they happened was the kind of person I became at the University of Wisconsin. It was the intellectual curiosity that I developed and the broad scope of my education at Wisconsin that helped me adjust and helped me take full advantage of all of the opportunities I've had along the way. And the breadth of that education was matched by its high quality. As a result of that education, too, I am convinced that I've been a better citizen, that I've been a better husband, a better father, even a better grandfather. There are several addenda which I now add for whatever they are worth. The first has to do with Ray Dvorak. Ray Dvorak was a legendary conductor of the Wisconsin band who came there shortly after I had left. But I knew Ray Dvorak at the University of Illinois, where I sang under him as the director of the Men's Glee Club, and where I played under him in the Parole Show, which was Illinois' version of the Wisconsin Haresfoot musical comedy group. Not only did Ray Dvorak direct the Parole Show, he also wrote most of the music for the show, and how he did it, I do not know, but he sold the show for 2 weeks to the Fox Midwest Go Theater circuit, so we played a number of towns around the state of Illinois. I did not mention eating places earlier, because for the most part I ate at the dormitory or ate at the boarding house. When I did eat out, I usually ate at Thompson's Restaurant or the Brat House. There is a story, perhaps apocryphal, which illustrates the level of intensity of college athletic recruiting at that time. It was said that when the freshmen lined up to sign up for physical education in front of the old red gym, that Doc Meanwell, the basketball coach, and Dad Vail, the crew coach, used to walk up and down the line and divide up the tall men who were there registering. Now a couple of other Glee Club notes, and that will be it. The Wisconsin Glee Club, when they appeared in formal concert, appeared in white tie and tails, with red sashes across their chests, much like a foreign dignitary would wear his medals. One summer, there were enough of us in town for the Glee Club to do a summer concert series, which was held every Sunday afternoon at the Memorial Union. On further thought, there are a few more observations I would like to make. One goes back to the question of wage levels and price levels which prevailed at that time. I do now recall that I got 25 cents an hour for my work as a draftsman at the agricultural department. While I was working there, in a room below my drafting office, there were two graduate students who were employed by the Wisconsin Sauerkraut Association. Periodically, they would appear through a trapdoor like Mephistopheles in the Wagnerian operas, carrying with them a small bucket of their latest batch of sauerkraut. Fortunately, I liked sauerkraut and didn't mind being a sample of one. The point to this story, however, is that these two graduate students lived for 2 years on the $3,000 scholarship which they had received from the association. When I worked on the FERA lecture project, I got $75 a month and on certain days $2 a day expenses. When I went to Washington for my first job, I was at an annual salary of $1,440 less 15%, which comes out to around $100 a month. And that was enough to let me go back to Chicago, get my bride, and come back to Washington. And I'd like to say a little something about Wisconsin theater in days before the theater in the Memorial Union. In those days, the plays were held in Bascom Hall. I remember several outstanding plays, particularly Luigi Pirandello's Six Characters in Search of an Author. Herman Werke, who played the lead in many of those plays, was good enough that he earned his way through medical school by playing in the local stock company. If somewhere in your researches you come to references of Werke's boathouse where we could rent sailboats, Herman Werke was a son of that family. Then there were the major dances, usually two of them in the year. One was the prom and the other was the military ball. At some time or other, I am sure we had most of the big bands of the era, Hal Camp, Wayne King, even Guy Lombardo. Sometimes there even were two bands, one playing upstairs and one playing downstairs in the Memorial Union. I remember one military ball when I believe Fletcher Henderson was playing upstairs, but most of us preferred to go downstairs to hear McKinney's Cotton Pickers. Bunny Berrigan, the legendary jazz trumpeter, had a small group which used to play around the fraternity houses. One other little note about how history repeats itself, and then I really will stop. In the late 50s, I was a guest lecturer at the Summer School of Banking that was run by Herb Prochnow and Fay Elwell. Guess where I gave my lectures? Yes, in the auditorium at Sterling Hall, right where I started freshman chemistry. Now, I have taken my time, I was relaxed, and I have enjoyed the interview. Best of luck with your project.